Hello and welcome to this podcast from the Business Marketing Club, or BMC. My name's Dave Stevens. I'm a B2B marketer and I'm chair and co-founder of the BMC. The Business Marketing Club is a not-for-profit community network of B2B marketing professionals and people interested in B2B marketing. It's run by B2B marketers for B2B marketers, and we provide face-to-face and virtual event meetups, training, podcasts, blogs, newsletters, mentoring, social media groups, community groups, and gatherings for B2B marketers. Today, we've got over 1,000 participants across the world. And if this is the first time, though, that you've joined us, you're very welcome. Check us out at businessmarketingclub.org.uk. If you've been with us before, well, it's great to have you back. Welcome. Are you ready, set? Then let's go. My guest today is a legend in marketing circles. Rory Sutherland is the vice chairman of Ogilvy in the UK and co-founder of that business's behavioural science practice. He's variously been president of the IPA, chair of judges for the direct jury at Cannes, and speaker at TED Global. He's the author of two books, The Wiki Man and Alchemy, The Surprising Power of Ideas Which Don't Make Sense. And he's behind the LinkedIn B2B Institute's recent paper, The Objectivity Trap. Rory, welcome to our podcast.
It's a huge pleasure to be on. And what a worthwhile thing you do, too. So I'm very, very grateful to you for doing it.
It's great to have you here. And thanks a lot. So first of all, can you tell us a bit about what Ogilvy is focused on right now?
So obviously, we're now in what? I suppose the first half of October, and it's still a whole miasma of COVID uncertainty surrounds us. But one small thing we've noticed is that in some ways the COVID crisis has brought marketing a little to the fore, because more and more business questions are now overtly behavioral questions.
Yeah.
I think actually a lot of business questions have always been behavioural questions, but they've been kind of behavioural questions in disguise. And people prefer to talk about, you know, supply chain management or rationalisation or something than they do talking about consumer behaviour, because consumer behaviour is inherently a bit messy and fuzzy, whereas things like procurement and supply chain management are reassuringly kind of mechanistic and straightforward. But now, of course, you know, whereas if you're an airline 6 months ago, you'd be having a discussion in your board about how you hedge fuel prices. Your discussion now is how the hell do we get people back onto planes? And so one of the dangers, I think, that always happens with large organizations is they start to take customer demand a bit for granted, because they make projections that if it's growing, it's growing. If it's falling off, it's falling. And they tend to make decisions based on the assumption that next year is going to be much like last year. And it's only when you get very dramatic simultaneous change, a kind of large simultaneous shock, that you really realize how important understanding your customers is, because you can no longer make assumptions about them on a kind of aggregate level. You have to get a bit more granular and you have to understand why they're really buying and what it is that's really keeping them off the plane, not just making do with a kind of convenient post-rationalization.
So it's great to hear that you take the view that marketing has greater importance in these days. I think if I look at some of your writings have been very much around how to position marketing properly within the business overall. And maybe we could start with the objectivity trap, which I think covers the biases and misconceptions that cause us all to undervalue business marketing. And I wonder, would you say that business marketing, even during COVID times, is undervalued, or is it simply well targeted and therefore less visible?
No, I think marketing is, the importance of marketing is always understated. Where it's most acute, I think, is probably in B2B. You know, if you are selling confectionery, for example, or you're selling soap powder, you accept the fact that perceptual factors have a major bearing on business success. But what we like to do in our quest for kind of certainty, and to be honest, in our quest to actually make rational seeming decisions that avoid the risk of blame, we fall back on this thing I call the objectivity trap, which is the pretense that the moment someone puts on a suit or sits next to a spreadsheet, they suddenly divest themselves of all their past perceptual biases and heuristics and become a completely rational calculating engine only interested in utility and price. And of course, the origin of this myth is really mainstream economics, which I think has done actually countless amounts of harm, immeasurable harm to business decision making. Because in the quest to make a model of human behavior that resembled physics, what economists really did is they constructed an imaginary model of an imaginary world, which bears no relation to the reality in which businesses operate. So in particular, the model that economists created is very unfriendly to time. It doesn't really understand time. It treats life as a series of one-shot games. So it's very unfriendly to the idea of relationships, for instance. But it's also incredibly unfriendly to marketing, because if you think about it, the standard economic model assumes perfect information, stable preferences, and perfect trust. Now, in such an environment, marketing wouldn't need to exist. If everybody knew exactly what they wanted, how much they were prepared to pay to get it, they knew to the penny how much utility they derived from its purchase, and they completely trusted the person who was selling it to deliver, then I freely admit, in that fantasy world, you wouldn't need marketing at all. And because a lot of business modeling comes from that fantasy world, what it does is it creates an imaginary world where marketing wouldn't need to exist, which then causes people who operate in that world or who frame the world that way to see marketing as a cost, a necessary evil, if you like. It's a cost to be minimized. It's not a source of value creation. And I think that's incredibly dangerous, because marketing is a huge source of value creation and should be viewed ambitiously rather than defensively. And yet most marketers now find their time spent almost justifying their existence down to the nearest penny, rather than making the fairly simple point, which is that people can't buy something if they've never heard of it. And by the way, 30% of the value of marketing comes down to something, a statement literally as banal as that.
But to kind of just pick at the business decision making being too rational point, we do, when we make procurement decisions in many organizations, there's typically a scoring sheet that we complete to guide our decision making. So isn't procurement rational?
Well, I think there's something very interesting. I don't know if you know from Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow, he makes the distinction between System 1 decisions and System 2 decisions. System 1 tends to be, less reflective. It's more instantaneous. It's more knee-jerk. It's faster. It involves less cognitive effort. And then there are System 2 decisions, which are kind of involve a large amount of deliberation. And if you know those procurement score sheets, and if you've ever participated in an exercise where the buyer is using them, okay. And in theory, what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to have a balanced scorecard, and you add up, let's say the agency is presenting, and you score them against, strategic insight, creative ability, chemistry, understanding of our business, price, of course.
Yeah.
Okay. And you have a balanced score for each out of 20. Okay. Now, if you then ask anybody who's participated in one of those exercises, did you in fact use that framework to arrive at your decision? Particularly if you ask them after a couple of drinks, they will almost invariably say, no, I decided, using System 1 effectively, I decided who I wanted to win, and then I backfilled the numbers. I reverse engineered the process to get the results I wanted. And there are lots of reasons, of course, because actually that decision isn't really a balanced scorecard. So if, for example, chemistry was only 5 points, but you absolutely loathed the people and gave them naught, well, that would only knock down their overall utility to you by 5%, say. But in reality, working with people you utterly detest would be more or less impossible. And so the fact that you might actually use an emotional decision to overrule a weighted decision. I would also make a very important point there, which is that it also makes it very possible. A weighted scorecard allows individuals within the process to game the system, because nuanced people who are scoring 7, 17, 15, 14, etc., out of 10 or 20, okay, have very little influence in the process, where somebody who simply put naught for five of the bidding people and 20 for the sixth would effectively carry the decision. I know this because my friend Dave Trott, who's a great advertising man, great advertising copywriter, when he sat on awards juries, which used a numerical system of additive selection, used to simply give entries 10 or naught. And he argued either they deserve an award, in which case I give them 10, or they don't give don't deserve an award, in which case I give them naught. And David Abbott, who was also on the jury, said, you can't do that. It's not fair, because your decision is basically deciding who gets an award and who doesn't. And that explains perhaps where Dave Trott is a bit more of a predatory thinker than David Abbott is. But I mean, it would be possible, you know, for a procurement person who is obsessed only with price, for example, to simply award 20 or naught on the basis of price and effectively render all the other criteria moot. So, but it's a classic case where it's the pretense of rationality. It's we are engaging in performative actions to give our decision the appearance of rationality, to defend it from subsequent blame, because we might have been deemed to have been subjective. And I would argue it's a purely symbolic activity. It doesn't actually influence people's preferences at all. It's there as a form of kind of rationalist theatre and nothing better than that.
So that's a great answer with some great examples there. What would you say is the opportunity cost of businesses being more behavioural in their decision making?
Well, the opportunity cost when businesses are forced to be entirely rational. First of all, there's a metrics problem, because one way in which you can innovate in a business is by not only winning at the game, but by rewriting the rules of the game. So if you're dependent on metrics that are predefined as your definition of success, okay, then one of the problems with metrics is metrics generally damage creativity. Because when you create lots of proximate metrics, you reduce the solution space significantly. So let's imagine for a second, okay, you're a cab firm pre-Uber. And you said, we've got market research that tells us, and a perfectly rational argument that tells us, that people like their cabs to arrive quickly. And therefore, we're going to measure the success of your cab firm on how quickly the cabs arrive. And that becomes automatically an engineering problem. It's not a psychological problem, because you've used an engineering unit, which is time or distance, not a psychological unit.
Yeah.
What Uber did is they focused on a psychological metric, a customer psychology metric, which is, broadly speaking, uncertainty. The reason people like their cabs to arrive fast is not so much because they're in a hurry to leave. It's because they can't stand the uncertainty of waiting for a cab. You spend 20 minutes on tenterhooks, looking out of the window, unsure whether every Mercedes that turns up is yours or just a coincidence. The whole thing is anxious-making and deeply unpleasant to the human mind. Now, Uber solved the problem, not necessarily by making cabs turn up faster, but by providing a map so you could see where your cab was. Now, that, I would argue, is a psychological solution to the problem of waiting, not an engineering solution. Now, the second you use engineering-defined metrics or economically-defined metrics, you've defined it as an engineering problem, and the solution space is now much smaller, because possible psychological solutions. Actually, deep down, what matters is not how long customers have to wait, but how long they feel they're waiting and how anxious they feel while they're waiting. Once you've, if you actually had set out with those metrics to begin with, you would have come up with a map. But the second you start defining a problem in economic terms, you've defined a problem that only economically minded people can solve. And as a result, lots of people are frozen out of the solution space who would have valuable, and in the case of Uber, a very, very low cost, efficient solution to the problem.
Do you think, though, that your direct, because whenever I've heard you talk about this, it's been to audiences of marketers, which is probably because I'm a marketer, right? And therefore I'm probably more predisposed to hear you in that context. But I wonder if the right audience for this discussion is CEOs who need to change the way that their companies make decisions.
Well, that came to one of the most interesting, it's worth remembering that the marketer typically in these days isn't on the board. They also have a relatively short tenure and spend most of their time trying to justify their value in terms of something like media spend, when the real value of marketing actually is nothing to do with anything marketing does. It's the value of how marketing sees the world, which is the customer-framed mindset must be present in any business decision that involves customers in any way. Okay, I mean, you know, logistics, you know, at some level can be viewed as purely an engineering problem. Okay. But as soon as you're doing something that has a bearing on customers, then to make that decision without representing the deeper customer viewpoint, in other words, based on something very shallow like market research or economic assumptions about utility, causes you, I think, to make grievous errors in many cases or to focus on entirely the wrong things.
Mm.
So Kotler was always supposed to have said, what gets measured gets managed. And two things are really interesting about that quote, one of which I always thought that's a really weird thing for an Austrian to say, because Kotler was an Austrian, his dad was an Austrian school economist, best mates with Joseph Schumpeter. The Austrians, as economists, are highly skeptical about mathematization of economics. So I thought for someone like Kotler to say that was a bit weird. And then it turned out that not only did he never say it, okay, it's the first point, but the person who did say it meant it as a criticism. Because he goes on to say, what gets measured, you could paraphrase it as what gets mismeasured gets mismanaged.
Right.
That what gets measured gets managed, even to the extent where companies will pursue at extraordinary cost to themselves things which have no bearing on the value they create for their customers. And so it was intended not as a promise, but as a warning. And it's very interesting because it occurs to me that if you think about it, when we try and make a business look rational, when we try and make a decision look rational, our idea of rationality is something that, broadly speaking, employs what you might call SI units, okay? The units of science, time, distance, weight, you know, right, sound reproduction quality, those kind of rational metrics, okay? And of course, that immediately starts from the entirely bogus assumption that there's a linear relationship between the objective qualities of a product or service and its emotional value to the person who consumes it.
Yeah.
And first of all, our perception hasn't evolved remotely objective senses of perception. So you'll know that from American weather forecasts when they go 74 degrees feels like 69. And that factors in things like wind and humidity, which actually distort how we perceive temperature. But if you come to things like time, our perception of time, and we know this actually from linguistics, okay, time flies when you're having fun, stroke, it was the longest 20 minutes of my life, okay, right? We know this from, you know, from simple phraseology, that our perception of time is very, very elastic indeed. Mm-hmm. And therefore, optimizing duration, for example, which looks scientific and rational, might involve a complete misdirection of effort towards things that consumers don't care about. One example of that I discovered actually was call center answering time, where everybody focuses on reducing the number of the delay to callers. Okay, now, here are two problems with that metric. One, it measures the time between someone making a call and their query being answered. Not the quality of that time, it measures the duration. Now, as a result, a very useful technology where you promise to call someone back doesn't actually solve your problem metrically. Okay? Now, in Israel, it's brilliantly illegal for any company to keep someone on hold for more than 60 seconds without offering them the option of a callback. Okay? Brilliant, brilliant bit of legislation. Whoever that guy was in the Knesset, I take my hat off to him, okay? But also, by the way, between 10 seconds and 1 second, we don't really care at all, apparently. You know, if your call's dealt with within 10, 15 seconds, so all the effort spent trying to minimize that delay is entirely fruitless. And secondly, the real way to solve the problem, because sometimes there will be 2-minute delays, is actually to change the quality of the wait, not its duration. Right. And so we're actually, in a sense, this happens in the NHS. You have NHS metrics like time between admission to A&E and being seen by a necessary specialist. So what the NHS started doing is leaving people in ambulances in the car park, because then technically they hadn't been admitted. And so you'd reduce the time. That's why you can't get an appointment 3 days ahead with your GP, because the metric says what matters is how many patients get seen on the day they request an appointment. And so everybody games the system. And so exactly what gets measured gets managed. And it's a stupid thing to measure. And as a result, it's a completely counter... I mean, literally, it's a value-destroying act to actually manage it. And there are many people with jobs need to know they can get a doctor's appointment on Friday so they can ask their boss, can I have Friday off? Yeah. Those people aren't catered for, because if you ring on Wednesday and say, can I have a doctor's appointment on Friday? They say, no, call back at 8 o'clock on Friday morning. And I actually took the piss out of this, because I had to give a talk to some medical audience at the, it's something like the Royal Institution of General Practitioners. And I had trouble finding the building. It's on the Euston Road. And I said at the beginning of my talk, I was nearly late for this because I couldn't find the building. And I said, I did have the phone number for the Royal College of General Practitioners, but I thought there was no point in ringing up and asking for directions, because they'd just tell me to ring back at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. And so these metrics are stupid. They're designed to make us look rational, and they make us act like idiots, because it's based on an assumption of customer objectivity, that what people care about are things that happen to coincide with kind of physical units.
Okay.
But what people care about is often a smile. Well, there isn't an SI unit for, when I pay by credit card at Selfridges, they say, thank you very much, Mr. Sutherland, because they bothered to read my name from the credit card. Okay. There's no SI unit for that. Maybe that's what we need. Maybe what marketing needs is some really good psychometrics, you know, based around insights into behavioral science. Maybe that's my next book. You know, what are the SI units in psychology, like irritation, uncertainty, you know, insult, you know, mistrust? We don't have an SI unit for trustworthiness, do we? Okay. So all the things we've evolved to care about don't map at all neatly onto all the things that rational people are trying to improve.
Would you say that there are any organizations that do behavioral decision making well today?
Yeah, Apple is an obvious and very boring example to give, but it is worth remembering that Steve Jobs, much to the irritation of him, to people within Apple, he basically asked a different question. Everybody else was asking, what can you get a phone to do? And Steve was asking the question, yes, fine, but what does it feel like while you're doing it? And I'd also argue that, for instance, you know, Dyson must, you know, it doesn't make any sense, Dyson. I mean, if you'd asked me, is there a market for a $700 vacuum cleaner 10 years ago, I would have told you to piss off, you know, and loads of rational reasons not to do it. Look at the market currently. No one's paying $700 for a vacuum cleaner. Anybody who could afford to do that can afford a cleaner, so they probably don't even vacuum the house themselves. And a vacuum cleaner is a distress purchase, you know, forget about it. And yet that's a $1 billion company. He's a billionaire. I'm obviously not. Okay. So what's obvious when we look at successes, everything from Starbucks to Nespresso to Dyson to Five Guys to Apple, I would argue, nearly always those organizations have tapped into something which is a psychological truth, which their competitors, who are more rational, somehow failed to notice, I would argue. Maybe they did so by accident. I think in Apple's case, it was done intentionally. I think it was driven more by Steve's ego than by his concern for customers, to be absolutely honest. You know, he wanted to look like the coolest person on the planet, so you had to make him products that satisfied that belief. But nonetheless, I think that psychological innovation is actually more important and more valuable economically than technological innovation. And yet we focus almost exclusively on the latter, not on the former.
Okay. Okay, let's come to your latest book, Alchemy, and this plays to the importance of acting less rationally too, and offers 11 rules of alchemy. One of my favorites is solving problems using rationality is like playing golf with only one club. Tell us a bit more about that.
I think that comes back to that metrics thing, which is, do you want to make a good decision or do you want to make a decision that's easy to defend? And a huge amount of business rationality is really arse covering disguised as rigor. Okay. It looks rigorous to do huge amounts of research. It looks rigorous. In many cases, actually, it doesn't influence the decision being taken. It's there, to quote a wonderful Scottish philosopher, it's often attributed to David Ogilvy, but sadly he didn't say it first. People use statistics as a drunk uses a lamppost for support rather than illumination. And in the same way, I think that's true of a large part of what you might call business information and business intelligence. It's there to defend the person who's making the decision from potential blame in the event that things go wrong. It's not really there to inform the decision at all. Mm. And I once suggested something to market research companies. I said, when you come to present your research findings, why don't you play a trick on the buggers who've requested the research and say, the research we're going to present is one of these three possible findings. And you present two imaginary findings and one real finding in no particular order. And then you say, in each of these three cases, what will you do differently? And they're forced to say, well, obviously, if we find that two is true, we'll have to invest much more in this. See, because they can't just say, well, regardless of what this research tells us, we'll end up doing the same thing anyway, because that would make them look ridiculous. Okay. Now, if you actually forced people to make a decision on the basis of four hypothetical research results and then presented them with the real research findings, you would at least force them to act on what you told them. Mm. Whereas at the moment, so often people cherry pick research for something that confirms their initial instinctive knee-jerk reaction and then simply selectively mine the research for whatever supports it. And I think there is something really important here, which is a huge amount of business time is wasted in people essentially covering their own arses because they can't be seen to be making a decision subjectively, even though the origins of that decision are subjective. And that exercise we talked about at the beginning, where you have the balanced scorecard, typical procurement. Let's pretend this is a numerical exercise because, like, fuck it is. But I mean, you know, I mean, it's a typical kind of bullshit idea that you can shoehorn business decisions into a spreadsheet framework. But of course, if you do that, if you can successfully shoehorn a decision into a totally artificial mathematical model that bears no relation to reality, you probably get to keep your job if everything goes tits up.
So okay.
This is the vital distinction I point out in the objectivity trap. In consumer decision making, we're frightened of regret. We're frightened of making a decision we regret. Okay. In business decision making, we're frightened of blame. Mm. And as a result, individual within large corporate entities, less so among entrepreneurial organizations where there's more skin in the game, but in large corporate entities, blame avoidance is actually a bigger game than decision optimization. And so it leads to this over-dependence on rational, well, post-rationalization or pre-rationalization or whatever you want to call it, you know, on spurious kind of rational models simply in order to defend the decision. And sometimes, by the way, sometimes, I mean, a very interesting case in point once. I once went to a prospective new business client, which I think had some business at Ogilvy and possibly owed it money. And the client, I noticed, had a £60,000 Rolex watch or thereabouts. It was the kind of watch which would, you know, it was the price of a luxury car. And I just thought, this is a bit weird. And there was also outside their offices, there was one of the, a Maybach was parked outside their office. I thought, this is a bit rum because in all my days of dealing with worthwhile clients, I've never come across anything like that. Either the watch is fake, in which case it's a bit odd, or the watch is genuine, in which case it's really odd. Okay. And I went back and people said, do you think we should do business with these people? I couldn't see a single rational reason to say no. But I felt uneasy because there were a few kind of telltale warning signs that things weren't quite normal. But I didn't feel I could advance them because you can't really say, no, we should turn down this business because the guy had a funny watch. Now, it subsequently turned out that the business was actually deep down, if you traced it back, it was run by the mafia in Malmo, I think. Okay. And my instincts were there were spot on. Okay, there's something here that's not quite right. But you can't put up a PowerPoint slide which says decided to decline business because of dodgy watch. Okay. And so as a result, you know, we're denied the ability to deploy our instinctive intelligence in business decisions in many cases, when in truth, our instincts are probably telling us something that might be worth knowing. That's why they're instincts, okay? Because evolution has selected for them.
So your alchemy rule 5, then, let's come on to that one. That's a flower is simply a weed with an advertising budget. I love that one. Tell us more about that.
No, this is an important point because most models of advertising tend to be a communication or information transmission model. That what you're doing, and economics again drives people to that conclusion, that what you're doing is you're telling people things, either arguments or facts, which will change their opinion.
Yeah.
And I argue that a highly significant part of advertising, actually its efficacy is derived from its cost. So that making advertising efficient may be a mistake because we infer from someone who's spending a lot of money on advertising that they have high confidence in the future widespread popularity of the product they're plugging. Because if they didn't have that confidence in the long-term popularity of that product, it wouldn't pay them to advertise.
Yeah.
Okay. And so when someone spends 5 million quid advertising a car, what it says reliably to me is test driving that car for half an hour won't be a complete waste of my time, because if my first impression is that this car is shite, they wouldn't have bothered advertising in the first place. And so we're using highly intelligent social intelligence, in a sense, to inform a decision. And by the way, to some extent, flowers work that way. It's not only that bees can see them. Bees and hummingbirds seem to have a preference for larger flowers because you wouldn't invest heavily in a large display of petals if your supply of nectar meant that customers didn't come back. If bees weren't likely to come back and continue to pollinate you, okay, because they found the pollen and nectar reward too meager, then it only pays to advertise your nectar supply in the event that you expect repeat custom. And in the same way, that's a highly intelligent inference, that's not quite true. Economics understands signaling, as does evolutionary biology. But this all goes back to a paper called The Market for Lemons, published by George Akerlof sometime back in the 70s or 80s. But the point is that we need reliable signals of seller quality, and the cost of the message transmission, or indeed the cost of creativity that's gone into it, using a celebrity, using fantastic typography, a brilliant photographer, craftsmanship, beautiful copywriting, elegant lines, humor, okay? All of these things are effortful to produce and therefore contribute to the credibility that's invested in the signal. And I can put it for you in one sentence, okay? A flower is a weed with an advertising budget. I don't think anybody among your 5,000 or so listeners has ever thrown away a FedEx envelope unopened. Okay? If I send you something by, you know, second class post, you know, if I drop something through your letterbox, you might just chuck it straight in the bin. If I insert it in a publication, you might chuck it in the bin. If I send it to you by UPS, you'll open it and you'll open it first. Because you're instinctive, and it is instinctive, not many people do this calculation. The instinctive inference is somebody who spent 8 quid sending me something probably has something important to say.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we forget that advertising works that way. We get obsessed with micro-targeting. But the point about micro-targeting is when you reach me with a banner on a website, to be honest, all I know is that you've spent 0.1p to reach me. It doesn't say anything. If you used George Clooney on a banner, well, either you're a complete bunch of crooks or you have actually given George some money and it actually means something. So I argue that in many cases we should make more use of celebrities and rich creative craftsmanship in low cost ads than we may need to do in TV, because in TV the media cost does some of the lifting.
Your first book, Rory, The Wiki Man, takes us on your career journey to becoming vice chairman at Ogilvy.
Rare is probably a bit too elegant a word to confer on it. You know, random walk might be a bit better, but yeah, no, go on.
So what skills and qualities got you here?
I think in a weird way, I'm a bit slow, by which I mean I tend to be the kind of person who wants to work everything out from first principles. And in the short term in your career, that's a disadvantage. Other people can build very, very successful careers in the beginnings of their working life by basically copying other successful people. And I probably lacked the social skills to do that, convincingly at least. I could try. Now, I learnt a lot from very successful people by quizzing them and questioning them. But I didn't really know how to do that copying thing of kind of fake it until you make it. And I think part of that was I kind of had to puzzle all this shit out for myself. And so that might, the other thing is probably I've been lucky being at Ogilvy, which is a big enough organization and open-minded enough to allow me to reinvent myself within it without having to leave. And enormous thanks for them for that. Over, you know, a 30-year period, there have been about 10 people at Ogilvy without whom I never could have done any of this. I think the other aspect is I'm a bit of an opportunist in that I don't really, this is why I don't call it a career, because I don't really plan it. The only skill I do have, which I think it might have abandoned me. And to be honest, the belief that I have this skill may be just a kind of, you know, narrative bias. But I think I spot significant trends quite well. So in my defense, I first used the internet in 1987. My brother was an academic, an astrophysicist. And so I used to blag computer time from him, basically using his login. And I was using Usenet news groups. And even in 1987, when there was no web, there was no graphical element to it at all. It was entirely textual. I remember thinking, this is going to be really big one day. And so when the web came out, I did kind of bet the farm on that in terms of going around Ogilvy and saying, this is really, really important. Do not neglect the importance of this medium. And in fact, you know, David Ogilvy helped because he'd always instilled in Ogilvy, you know, he'd been a huge enthusiast for direct mail and direct marketing when it was completely unfashionable. He was a big believer in B2B advertising. And as a result of Ogilvy's direct marketing strength, we always had a disproportionate number of B2B customers. But David had also always been open-minded and experimental about new ways to advertise. So the culture at Ogilvy was always, if something comes along that's new and different, we don't reject it and hope it goes away. We investigate. And that permeated, I think, the whole company culture. You know, I'm not suggesting we all wear what would David do bracelets all day, but nonetheless, he had a curious and an experimental mind. And so the interesting thing was, you know, I've been able to, and the other thing I would argue is, I mean, my other bit of prescience recently has been, before COVID, I spotted the fact that video conferencing, what we're doing now, in fact, was a grotesquely underused technology. And for 2 years, I have been spending time pre and post COVID trying to find out what those obstacles to wider adoption were. And you know, there were more, the interesting thing, of course, there were several, there were many. Right. Most of them, I think, were social and psychological, not technological. I mean, Zoom has been pretty good now for 2 years. Microsoft Teams was getting good before getting tolerable before COVID came along. It's worth saying that, you know, there was WebEx, there was Cisco, there was BlueJeans. The tolerably high quality video calling technology was kicking around 3, 4, 5 years ago. Some of them took a completely wrong turn, like Skype, because they modeled it on a phone call, not on a meeting. So you rang someone else, which is an unbelievable imposition when done through video. You know, suddenly appearing in someone's room, you know, almost with their camera on is not something you can anybody with any social sensitivity at all will feel massive discomfort doing it. So Zoom got the structure right, which is you have a URL for the meeting. You click on the URL, it launches in the browser, the technology's on the cloud. They got something significantly right.
Yeah.
But even so, for 2 years beforehand, I was looking at the various obstacles, and most of them are social, network, or psychological. They're not actually, you know, the technology problem, and this is why this is important, okay, is that most modern problems are becoming marketing problems in disguise, because solar panels are now pretty good. Electric cars are now pretty good. The difficulty is actually getting people to put the panels on their roof. It's not the actual technology. That's already within sight of the finish line in terms of quality. Okay, it can get cheaper and cheaper. But the psychological problem, by the way, is interesting, because the entire tech world has taught us to believe that if you wait, everything becomes cheaper. So in certain technologies, it causes us never to do anything at all. And so, you know, that's a consumer problem. That's a marketing problem to be solved. This idea that every year I wait, I'm effectively, you know, getting better solar panels. So why do anything now? Creates a kind of Mexican standoff in a marketplace. But there's a whole load of other stuff. Why doesn't John Lewis, you know, supply and install solar panels? You know, the value of brands here could be absolutely enormous. Instead, if you want to install solar panels, to understand what's going on, you've practically got to take a degree in particle physics. I mean, and the way they describe the flaming value, they say these panels will take 9 years to repay their purchase cost in electricity savings. Well, that sounds shit, doesn't it, right? Okay. If you said, think of this as a savings product with an 11% return, you go, shit, that's a lot better than anything I'm getting at the moment, right? Yeah. I better get some panels. So they haven't even done the most elementary reframing of the value of the product.
I was going to ask you a bit about COVID and marketing as well.
So by the way, on that rationality point, the biggest mistake of rationalists is to think that price is price and that consumers perceive a dollar as a dollar as a dollar. They don't. Whether something's cheap or expensive depends entirely on what you compare it to, how you charge for it, whether you charge monthly, what the comparative frame is, what mood they're in, how they pay. Okay. When you pay contactlessly, everything feels 15% cheaper. Okay. It just does. Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, with my dad, I couldn't get my dad to get Sky, and he wouldn't pay £17 a month for the kind of for the family information. He doesn't want films or sport. He hates sport and doesn't like films. But he loves factual shit and news, okay? And he wouldn't pay the £17 for the Sky, like, nerd pack, you know, Sharks of the Serengeti or whatever, you know, okay. So I said, it's not £17 a day, Dad. It's 60p. He wouldn't buy it. I offered to pay for it for him. He still wouldn't get it. I then said, Don Draper mind trick here, okay? I said, but it's not £17 a month, it's 60p a day. He said, what difference does that make? I said, you spend £2 a day on newspapers. You're spending £2 a day on two broadsheet newspapers, spending another 60p to get 200 channels of, you know, the Third Reich in colour, is pretty much a bargain, isn't it? And he said, I see what you mean. And his perception of how much Sky cost was completely reformulated within 3 seconds. Now, everybody who's trying to be rational starts with that economic assumption that a dollar is a dollar is a dollar, and the amount of pain we experience in expending a dollar is the same whether we're buying Sky, whether we're comparing it to newspapers, whether we're comparing it to anything else. What my dad was comparing it to was the existing TV license fee, I think. So it seemed expensive. Now, one of the problems is that marketers have increasingly been frozen out of pricing discussions because they're seen as basically whoever came up with the phrase marcoms should be shot, okay? Because marketing, I consider the behavioral science practice to be a marketing entity. We're not a comms entity. We solve marketing problems using psychology through whatever means we have available, okay? And once marketing becomes comms and becomes seen as comms, it becomes a support function. It's not actually a source of strategic insight or value creation. And it's doomed. You're now repro graphics with A-levels, basically.
And Rory, you act as a consultant to businesses on many of the issues we've been discussing over the last half an hour or so. How can people get in touch with you to find out more?
Oh, at Rory Sutherland on Twitter. I'm on LinkedIn under Ogilvy. You can email me at rory.sutherland@ogilvy.com. That's rory.suth as in Kiefer. But that's where the resemblance pretty much ends. So rory.sutherland@ogilvy, which is Oscar Golf India Lima Victor Alpha. A Yankee, sorry. Oscar Golf India Lima Victor Alpha. Yankee.com.
Marvellous. Rory, it's an absolute joy to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time today. And that's all for this episode of the Business Marketing Club podcast. Thanks to my guest, Rory Sutherland, and thanks to our technical team from Through the Eye of Scott Jackson, Andrew Gratian, Alex Horn, and Josh Bench. Most of all, though, thanks to you for listening. Do rate or review us if you can, and email me at davestevensnow@gmail.com if you'd like to be a speaker or offer feedback. There's more where this came from. The Business Marketing Club is a not-for-profit community run by B2B marketers for B2B marketers, and you can check out our other webinars, podcasts, events, mentoring, blogs, newsletters, social media groups, gatherings, and community groups for business marketing professionals and people interested in business marketing. Just go to businessmarketingclub.org.uk. I hope to see you again. Thanks for listening.